This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, July 18th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Vice President Dick Cheney's energy plan comes under public scrutiny in Boston. Australians blame U.S.-style anti-abortion tactics for shooting inside a clinic in Melbourne. And Oklahoma now has the dubious distinction of being the death penalty capital of the U.S. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Tens of thousands have converged on the small town of Genoa, Italy, to protest and be heard by leaders of the world's eight largest industrialized powers. But as Patrick Beckett reports, diversions are leading in the headlines.
Italian bomb squads are on high alert today after a series of bombs in Genoa and other parts of Italy have been discovered. Over 15,000 military and police are providing security in this port city, where the group of seven plus Russia will meet this week. A small package bomb injured a police officer Monday, and police later defused a petrol bomb at a stadium elsewhere in the city. Tuesday night and Wednesday, there were several more explosions around Genoa. A spokesperson for the demonstration organizers, the Genoa Social Forum, said the blasts were contrary to the goals of the protest.
I think that somebody wants to cover up our thoughts, our reasoning. And we, as we have shown today, we have many ideas, many reasonings, and we don't need bombs for that, to prove our ideas and opinions.
From the Independent Media Center in Genoa, this is Patrick Beckett reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
At a press conference today, Russian President Vladimir Putin said George W. Bush is pleasant to talk to, but he disagrees with some of his counterpart's foreign policies. Lysakov Sergei reports from Moscow.
A system of international sanctions against Iraq is counterproductive, President Vladimir Putin said in the Kremlin. He said the most important thing was to get proof that Iraq was not getting ready for a war or producing weapons of mass destruction. Relations with Baghdad should be built on that basis, Putin said. He believes Iraq leadership should be convinced to admit international inspectors to the facilities and to move on towards lifting the sanctions. If they stay forever, they will never produce the desired results, Putin said. Lysakov Sergei from Moscow for Free Speech Radio News.
CIA Director George Tenet was a no-show at a congressional hearing on the CIA's refusal to cooperate with congressional inquiries. Ravi D'Souza reports from the Capitol.
This was the last straw for Illinois Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, who highlighted the CIA's consistent refusal to provide information to Congress. She said she was stonewalled by the CIA when requesting information on an American missionary plane shot down in Peru last April.
I was mystified and outraged. An American citizen and her infant daughter were killed. The United States played a prominent role, and now we have an agency telling Congress to mind its own business. This is our business, and I think we need to demand some answers.
Tenet sent a letter to Government Reform Committee Chair Stephen Horn, in which he defended his absence. The letter states that the agency would be fully compliant with congressional operations. He said, quote, "Let me be clear. The CIA has not questioned, nor will it ever question, the right of the Congress to have answers to questions it has asked." In the letter, the director also cited that the CIA is subject only to inquiry by the Intelligence Committee. From Washington, D.C., this is Ravi D'Souza for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush has nominated another former Iran-Contra figure to his administration. In the former President Reagan's administration, Otto Reich was given credit for correcting what he called CBS's and NPR's sympathetic coverage of guerrillas in El Salvador and Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Nicole Hallett has more from D.C.
The Bush administration's nomination of Cuban-born Otto Reich for Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs has sparked controversy because of his known propaganda violations during the Iran-Contra affair. William Goodfellow of the Center for International Policy joined Senators Kerry and Dodd in opposing the nomination, noting human rights in Latin America would suffer as a result.
Otto Reich is such a divisive figure. There's no foreign policy explanation on why they're sending this nominee up. They're doing it purely for domestic political considerations. It's Miami. It's pleasing the Cubans in Miami. And the interests of the Cubans in Miami are not necessarily the interests of the larger population, or for that matter, the interests of the Cuban people.
While other Bush nominees with controversial views have received Senate approval, Reich's irreputable past will be a tough sell to many. His confirmation hearing is scheduled to begin in early September. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Nicole Hallett.
And finally, the North Carolina State House approved a bill that would prevent executing the mentally retarded. After debating the issue for over 2.5 hours, the House came to a close vote of 62-50 to support the bill. The bill is a variation of the one already approved by the state Senate, which is where the bill will go back to for a final revision. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The United Nations' top climate negotiator accused the United States today of stonewalling attempts to reach an international agreement on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. President Bush abandoned the Kyoto Global Warming Pact in March, saying it was flawed and would hurt the U.S. economy. Officials from about 180 nations are meeting in Bonn through next week to try to save it. In addition to the United States, environmentalists accuse Japan, Canada, and Australia of undermining talks on a treaty limiting emissions of greenhouse gases with new demands. With the United States standing aside, Japan's role is crucial. The accord can only enter into force if backed by 55 countries, representing 55% of the industrialized world's emissions. If Japan pulls out, the second target can't be reached. For more on this story, we go to Charles Michael Ray in Bonn.
It was hoped by many at the start of the COP6 climate convention in Bonn, Germany, that there could be a way to ratify the Kyoto Protocol without the United States. To achieve ratification would take the consent and input of Japan, a key nation needed to make the 55% majority of global pollutants needed to implement the protocol. But Japan has entered the conference without a clear position. Japan's Environment Minister, Yuriko Karaguchi, will not comment definitely whether it would join with the European Union to make the necessary majority to allow ratification. In the meantime, Karaguchi says Japan wants to try to get the U.S. to come back on board.
For Japan, the Kyoto Protocol is very important, and we are aiming at entry into force of the Kyoto Protocol by 2002. The first thing we should do is to come to an agreement on the implementing rules, on the detailed rules of the Kyoto Protocol, without which we cannot ratify.
In response, some environmental groups allege Japan is using its leverage to blackmail other countries into giving it everything it wants in the protocol. Kate Hampton is international coordinator at Friends of the Earth. She says after the collapse of the Hague talks last fall, the sense of urgency has been lost in these talks.
It is urgent. It's in terms of the environment's movement, and perhaps in the history of human civilization, there has never been a problem more urgent than the threat of climate change. The problem is that it is something that is going to, that is happening now, but the full effects of it will not be felt for decades. And unfortunately, our political system works on the basis of 2-year, 4-year, 5-year, 6-year election terms, and that's the planning horizon of most politicians and most governments. And I'm not proposing an alternate form of government where that would not be the case, but the fact is that we have to take decisions now which will affect our children and theirs. And if we don't, history will judge us very, 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 very harshly.
While environmental groups inside the conference say they will continue to push for ratification of the Kyoto Protocol, they add that it is wholly inadequate. Steve Sawyer with Greenpeace Climate International says more urgent action needs to be taken, especially after a recent release of a UN-sponsored intergovernmental study that said that global warming is happening much sooner and faster than thought 5 years ago. Some estimations predicted up to 150 million refugees can be expected when coastal regions of the world become flooded within the next century.
It depends entirely on the political courage of the parties at the table, particularly Japan. Hopefully, the US won't obstruct too much. Hopefully, parties will ignore Canada and Australia, who are obstructing already. Other countries like Saudi Arabia and Nigeria, big oil producing countries, are also obstructing. However, there is a willingness amongst most developing countries to move forward. There is a willingness amongst the EU to move forward. And we hope that a coalition will come together to save the protocol by the end of next week.
Meanwhile, other environmental groups protesting outside of the conference oppose implementation of the Kyoto Protocol, saying that it has been gutted by corporate influence and that it will be unable to reduce carbon emissions. Many argue that through corporate influence, the agreement has become an extension of neocolonialism, allowing corporations to buy and sell pollution credits and thus pollute poor areas of the world without consequence. While environmental NGOs inside the conference will work through this process to push for ratification of the protocol, outside, major street protests and actions are planned against the meeting itself. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Bonn.
A coalition of environmental and consumer groups is urging the Bush administration to take a harder look at the environmental and health impacts of gutting clean air rules to boost output at refineries and power plants. The Environmental Protection Agency is holding a series of public hearings around the country on Vice President Cheney's energy plan. Chuck Rosina reports on the EPA hearings in Boston, where environmentalists again opposed lowering chances a power plant or refinery will be fined for violating the Clean Air Act.
Yesterday, the Environmental Protection Agency held the third of four regional meetings, this one in Boston, Massachusetts, to take public comment on the New Source Review Program. The New Source Review, or NSR, is a Clean Air Act program that requires the best available pollution control equipment to be installed when a new source of air pollution is built, or when a pollution source makes a modification that significantly increases emissions. As part of his energy program, President Bush has ordered the EPA to review this critical portion of the Clean Air Act. Critics charge that the Bush administration is attempting to weaken this part of the act and that the environment and public health would suffer.
The state PIRGs, as I'm sure you've heard around the country, strongly oppose any efforts to weaken the NSR program and even more strongly oppose any efforts to allow the illegal polluters who have violated this provision off the hook.
Rebecca Stanfield is a clean air advocate for state public interest research groups. She testified at the hearing.
Some representatives would have us believe that the Clean Air Act provisions in question are so onerous as to discourage new investment in energy efficiency and electric and oil refining facilities. We believe that this is nothing more than an attempt to capitalize on the misfortunes of California electricity consumers and those suffering from higher energy prices across the country to push a change in policy that would have no measurable impact on future electricity reliability. Your report shows, your background paper, and we concur that the failure to invest in energy efficiency, new power plants, and new refineries over the last few years has little or nothing to do with clean air rules and everything to do with changes in the market structure of these industries. Utility and environmental regulators from California and New England have testified that uncertainty in the market and over-reliance on the spot power market led to the severe power shortages we saw in California earlier this year.
The hearing room was packed beyond capacity, with people standing in the aisles, along the walls, and out in the hallway entrance. Many of them carried signs and wore buttons calling for a strengthening of regulations, not a weakening. Jane Bright, an environmental activist, testified at the hearing.
So let's really get to what the real question on the table is, because you already know what the ramifications are of weakening NSR and effectively gutting the intent of the Clean Air Act. And the unspoken question really is, what's the political climate like? Can this administration get away with gutting the Clean Air Act or not? The answer to the question is, can the government get away with this, is no. We are talking about a policy that could increase pollution dumped on Americans that we know ahead of time is going to make them sick and in some cases cut their lives short. What is the moral question to do that? The answer ought to be that we know enough because we have the technology. This is not an either-or question. The technology exists to cut this pollution. The provisions are already on the books if only you will enforce them. The answer needs to be to protect the American people. The industry is well prepared to protect themselves. It is up to the government and the people's voice to be heard to protect us. Thank you.
The EPA is conducting this review of the NSR regulation in response to a recommendation made by the National Energy Policy Development Group under the direction of Vice President Cheney. The administrators were shown, in New England at least, people support a strong Clean Air Act. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina in Boston.
Anti-abortion activists continued to demonstrate outside a Melbourne, Australia abortion clinic 2 days after one of their members entered the facility and opened fire, killing a security guard. The attack on Dr. Bertram Weiner's clinic has shocked Australia, which has no precedent for what's being called a U.S.-style abortion shooting. But as Rachel Maher reports from Melbourne, it's not surprising to activists who note that radical U.S. anti-abortion groups have begun sending advisors to Australia.
Litany of the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Anti-abortionists outside a clinic in Melbourne today. The fatal shooting earlier this week of a security guard in an abortion clinic has shocked the community and raised grave concerns about the state of women's reproductive rights in Australia. The man charged with the murder, while being detained by police, is refusing to identify himself and is not formally linked with any group. Richard from anti-choice group Helpers of God's Precious Infants, who have continued their presence outside the clinic in Melbourne.
Well, we were hoping that they would close it down because, would stop operations. So if they're here continuing their killing, well, we have an obligation to be here to try and defend the babies that are in danger of being killed.
Richard blames the clinic itself for the tragic death of the security guard.
They know what they're doing is the cause of what happened. It's a violent mentality going on in there which is sort of contributing to this death.
This particular clinic, now run by a consortium of doctors, was the first in the state of Victoria, and its founders experienced continued harassment through the early years of its operation. Jo Weiner, who co-founded the clinic in Melbourne in 1972 with her late husband.
The right to life didn't exist in those days, and the anti-abortion movement didn't exist because women were being sufficiently punished by the trauma of having to undergo clandestine, illegal and sometimes incompetent abortion. Anti-abortion movements only came into existence when women started having access to lawful abortion, which was safe and dignified. And it's because of the need that anti-abortion people have to punish women for their sexuality, for their sexual behaviour, for their ritual autonomy, that we have an anti-abortion movement at all. It's nothing at all to do with saving fetal life.
There are serious concerns in the community that this attack mirrors a level of violence that is present in the United States, but previously unseen in Australia. Concern that this country is following a trend set in the US is based around evidence that Australian anti-abortionists are being mentored by their US counterparts. Jo Weiner again.
They turned to America for leadership and skills development, and they learnt a lot of their rhetoric and tactics from some of the more unpleasant aspects of American society and imported those into Australia. Australia doesn't have the extremist element that exists in America, and we're not a gun culture. So we don't have to deal until today with firearms. But what they did do was bring people like Joseph Scheidler out to teach them how to close an abortion clinic. And I have been present on many occasions when that clinic in particular has been surrounded by angry mobs shouting and blocking entry to doorways and harassing and intimidating women and their partners. So yes, we have had vigorous and extremely aggressive and semi-violent activities surrounding abortion providers in Australia now for a number of years, largely led by people who've been trained in the United States.
Lisa Solomon, convener of the Women's Electoral Lobby, cites a recent example of the effects of this mentoring.
I'm certainly not aware of formal connections. However, I am aware, for example, that late last year a nun came from Brooklyn, is my understanding, to train activists in the Brisbane area on what they call curbside counselling. And as a consequence of that, there was an escalation in harassment in and around abortion clinics in Brisbane for a while. I think it's most important that the general public realise the absolute radical nature of the anti-abortion lobby and the consequences of their intervention and harassment and abuse of women and their partners when they seek to have abortions in Australia.
The actions of this gunman have also reignited public support for women's reproductive rights as pro-choice activists rallied in Melbourne today. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rachel Maher in Melbourne, Australia.
A man who strangled a 64-year-old grandmother after breaking into her home in 1988 was put to death by injection late last night. Native American Gerald Wayne Harjo confessed to the murder after investigators found his muddy tennis shoe prints on Porter's floor. Authorities say Harjo broke into Ruth Porter's house to try to find the keys to her van and killed her in her bed. Harjo was the 14th person executed this year in Oklahoma, meaning Oklahoma has now passed Texas as the death penalty capital of the United States. Rennie McKay reports from Oklahoma City.
At 9:10 last night, the state of Oklahoma executed Gerald Harjo. Kevin Akers of Oklahoma City's chapter of Amnesty International and eight others gathered outside the governor's mansion to stand vigil.
I believe this is the largest number of prisoners ever executed in a single year in Oklahoma. Behind each execution is, of course, one or more victims who died, and the loss of those lives are a part of the tragedy of the loss of the 14 prisoners' lives, which we've seen in this first half or so of the year 2001.
The victim in this case was Ruth Porter, an elderly school secretary who Harjo suffocated and raped during a robbery of her home. Harjo was a Seminole Indian, and some death penalty opponents say his race and economic status contributed to his receiving the death penalty sentence. But the divisiveness surrounding this execution revolves more around ideology than around specific problems in the case. Death penalty opponents say the state is much too vigorous in its pursuit of the death penalty in cases that may not warrant it. Some say Harjo's case is an example of this. Regardless of ideology, the facts are that Oklahoma has attracted a lot of attention for its high number of executions this year. Officials say the reason for these executions isn't a bloodthirsty governor or attorney general, but simply the machinery of the criminal justice system. Eight cases from Oklahoma were sitting before the Supreme Court when they returned to work this January, and they quickly dismissed the appeals, which meant eight executions in 24 days for Oklahoma. That was a trying time for many people. Gerald Adams, spokesman for Attorney General Drew Edmondson, says he and his colleagues felt this as well.
Of course, it taxed our office a lot during that time to prepare both the legal matters and for the Pardon and Parole Board, the Clemency Board, to hear those cases.
That stretch of executions brought a lot of attention to the state and to the death penalty, both locally and internationally. And Kevin Akers says that came to a head during the execution of Wanda Jean Allen, the first woman executed in the state's history. She was black, mentally retarded, and a lesbian. 200 people joined him at the governor's mansion the night of her execution.
It's been a hard year, it's been a rough year, but it's been a year of real momentum in the movement against the death penalty. And not only the movement against the death penalty, but the movement against ignorance about the death penalty. I think our state's population is more aware of some of the complexities of this issue than they ever have been before.
The complexities of this issue have become very apparent in Oklahoma, and some of those complexities have caused people to take a closer look at the criminal justice system. One of those surfaced yesterday when a defense attorney brought a suit against the state for the wrongful execution of Malcolm Rent Johnson. Johnson was executed a year ago January, and he was one of many people convicted in part because of evidence presented by Joyce Gilchrist. She's Oklahoma's forensic expert and is currently suspended with pay because of allegations by the FBI that she may have lied in court, manufactured evidence, and done poor work. State agencies are reviewing 1,600 cases in which Gilchrist had a role, including 14 death penalty cases where the accused is still on death row. The suspension of Gilchrist is one incident Akers notes has been a major factor in the heightened attention on the death penalty in Oklahoma, but it's not the only one.
A lot of things have been happening almost simultaneously to really chisel away dramatically at the by and large status quo attitude of support for the death penalty. The fiasco about the FBI files around the McVeigh case, coinciding with the recent release several weeks ago of a prisoner who was wrongfully convicted of rape and basically sentenced to life in prison for a crime he didn't commit, and DNA evidence cleared him, and he was one of the Gilchrist cases. And then the Gilchrist scandal that has emerged really got people sort of shaken up a bit off of their complacency. You know, most people really want to have faith in our system. And it's a hard knock when we see that the system is so flawed that it makes the most magnanimous of us really, really question the validity of what's been going on in our criminal justice system.
One of the people taking a closer look at the system is Governor Frank Keating. He recently came out saying that he's in favor of a higher standard for the application of the death penalty, moving from beyond a reasonable doubt to a moral certainty. Keating spokesperson Phil Bacharach says several things probably contributed to the governor coming to this realization.
I can't completely get inside his head, but I can say that I don't think it was one factor that was more or less the straw that broke the camel's back. Several months ago, the governor commuted the sentence of Philip DeWitt Smith, who was on death row here, from the death penalty to life without the possibility of parole. The reason for that, the case was primarily built on two witnesses, both of whom recanted their testimony, one of whom later recanted the recantation. Rather convoluted case. It was the first time in 30-some-odd years that the governor in Oklahoma had commuted a death case. Then you have the Joyce Gilchrist matter, where the FBI's investigation of the lab already indicated severe problems, which led to, among other things, the release of a man who'd been convicted for rape. All of those things together obviously point to problems and challenges for the criminal justice system.
Bacharach says the governor is still a firm supporter of the death penalty and won't relent from that stance, but does want to ensure that no innocent person is executed. He also says the governor is willing to consider some other changes in state law regarding the death penalty, such as a ban on the execution of the mentally retarded. That's something Akers sees as possible as well.
It's the first time since I've been involved in this issue in Oklahoma that I have felt like there's a reasonable chance for real limits being placed on the death penalty in Oklahoma in the foreseeable future. Maybe not abolition, maybe not a moratorium, but I wouldn't rule either of those out.
But Oklahoma is a state that strongly supports the death penalty, as evidenced by their number of executions this year, and things aren't likely to happen too quickly. And public opposition to the death penalty isn't quite at the same furor it has been. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rennie McKay in Oklahoma City.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters on four continents and in 14 states are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. They need your support. For more information, go to the strike's website at www.savepacifica.net/strike. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Headlines editor, Randy Zimmerman. Technical producer, Jade Pageant-Seekins. Technical assistant, Matt Martin. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. This newscast was produced at WMNF Radio in Tampa and the Independent Media Center in New York. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.